Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Today we'll be having a discussion about reconciliation, the processes by which peoples who've been at war or had unequal status or have a history of conflict attempt to move past that conflict toward the goal of living together peacefully and as equals. It's a difficult road, especially after decades, if not generations, of racism, prejudice, and in some cases, genocide. How to forgive and how to recognize the past in a way that honors but doesn't shame. Those are some of the questions we're going to explore with four guests from different parts of the world, which are all at some stage of the reconciliation process. So let's have folks here introduce themselves. Aneli Muzikwa, let's start with you. What's your background and what does reconciliation mean in your home country, South Africa, at this moment?
Well, I'm from South Africa. I stay in Johannesburg. I grew up in Durban in a village called Mvuzo. Like I said, I currently stay in Johannesburg. I do a lot of work in the township in South Africa. I have a very long history in terms of the apartheid struggle, which is very personal to me and has quite a lot to do with the reconciliation process. Reconciliation to me means, at one point it meant revenge, but I think I've gone past that now. Reconciliation means coming together and healing, as well as making a connection with your present and your future and moving on.
Up next, we have Ivan Marovic. Tell us a little about yourself, your history, and what are the issues of reconciliation in Serbia?
I come from Serbia, which is one of the seven countries that came out of former Yugoslavia after the civil war that happened in the 90s. So for us, and for me personally, reconciliation is the process by which we are learning to become good neighbors when we couldn't live in one house. And then we had like a decade-long tension, conflict, and civil war with the ethnic cleansing and genocide, which was over some 12 years ago, but still the wounds are deep, and there is a need for reconciliation to heal these wounds, but also to have us live, because we are still in the same region and we have to live next to each other if we couldn't live together.
Thanks, Ivan. Arzu Gebulaeva is from Azerbaijan. I think the conflict in your part of the world is a little less well known than that in South Africa or Serbia. So Arzu, why don't you introduce yourself and talk just a little bit about what you do in regards to bringing people together?
Well, thank you, Andrew. My name is Arzu Gebulaeva. I am from Azerbaijan. It's one of the regions in the Caucasus. The conflict that we've been dealing with for the last several years, since 1994, actually, when we signed the ceasefire with Armenia, is over a territory called Nagorno-Karabakh. And my main job as a co-director of a small non-governmental organization called Imagine Center for Conflict Transformation is to work with young people from Armenia and Azerbaijan, bringing them together to dialogue retreats once a year when we go over history, we go over present-day fears, needs, concerns, and we discuss future project planning, because the big portion of the project is actually focused on building relationship between the people of the two countries, and especially between the two young people of the two countries. And we do focus a lot on social media and how we can incorporate these project cooperations through social media and run online publications. But this is in a nutshell.
Thanks. And the last of our four guests is Ahmed Mahmoud, a resident of Khartoum in Sudan. Ahmed, tell us what reconciliation means right now in 2012 in your homeland.
Well, Andrew, the word reconciliation, I actually got to learn it recently in 2011 after the secession of my country, which seceded into two countries, a geographical north and a geographical south, after one of the longest civil wars in Africa ended. I'm involved in a movement of nonviolent resistance, and we kind of established a campaign of reconciliation to finish building a school in the south, in particularly in Trolley town, which is a town that the basketball player Manute Bol was born in, and he was actually started building a school there, but unfortunately he died before finishing the school, so we kind of took on that. So yeah, I mean, in Sudan it's not only the south and north, which now it's two separate countries, but we also have to reconciliate with other parts of the country, because there's so many ethnical conflicts going on, and it appears like something happens every day that just adds to the fire.
And you had a rhyme you were going to kick, or a little poem about the situation?
Yeah, I kind of, on the Independence Day or the Separation Day of the South, everyone was in the North, everyone was kind of emotional about it. And I couldn't help but try to answer a question. Why is everyone suddenly all emotional? So it goes something like, last night I tried writing about unity and such. I couldn't draft that much. I couldn't even write the word Sudan Unite, because my pen knows that I memorized a lot of Jahili poetry and still don't know how Nuer tribes write. I learned more about how Sahaba used to fight, but I was never told of how Shuluk people love, or at the very least, what are the pickup lines. I learned more about Greek mythology than Dinka mythology. And oh, the ghost of Che follows me, but I hardly know of any southern prodigy, except for Jangarang maybe. Not so true, probably, because I could have said to him thank you in 5 different languages, you see. Thank you, shukran, arigato, gracias, and merci. But only today I learned how to say Yen Chalish 5 years after he passed away.
Nice. Ahmed is an MC, and we'll be linking to his music on our website. But I'm wondering, for the rest of you, hearing what each other have said, and also hearing that poem, what thoughts come to mind about some of the similarities, differences between in your different countries with the reconciliation process?
Well, I specifically like the part when Ahmed was talking about, you know, how they learn about different histories and how the warriors fought, but they don't learn how to respect each other or love each other. And this is I relate to this in Azerbaijan, because, you know, we learn, our history textbooks teach us, both in Armenia and Azerbaijan, that, you know, the other is the enemy. They occupied our territories. They killed women and children, innocent people. And none of us in Azerbaijan are taught how to reconciliate after that. In the present day, especially when we have the two governments together with Russian government as well, meet every now and then and discuss the peace treaty. But on the ground, when they come back to their countries, they continue their hatred speech and they continue propagating aggression. And I think that's very—it's very near to me and very close to me. But I would like to hear about other countries as well.
Well, for me, the song Ahmed just recited is actually very interesting, because we had our own emotional moment when Kosovo seceded like 4 years ago, and when it was like a huge blow for the self-esteem of the Serbian people especially. But you know, it was like the last episode in the decade-long conflict, which wasn't as long as the conflict in Sudan, but you know, it was long enough to create like a total chaos and disaster in the region. So, you know, the same like in Ahmed's song, you know, like I could, if I knew how to recite and if I knew how to, you know, if I could write a poem, I would be able to write a poem about, you know, how I don't know anything about, for instance, Albanian mythology or Albanian, how shall I say, folk tales, because we never learned that. And although we lived in the same country. And so then, you know, I could be now angry that the Albanians seceded from Serbia, you know. But I guess, you know, if I didn't care to learn anything, and actually I wasn't, you know, able to learn anything about Albanian mythology in school, or so then, you know, why should I be surprised if they don't want to live under the same roof with me? So I guess reconciliation is, you know, also for at least some of us, learning that, you know, people maybe don't like you anymore and they don't want to live with you, but to respect that. And that was probably the biggest challenge for Serbs, who thought that, you know, Yugoslavia, the country that they lived in, was the roof for all its nations, and they just couldn't understand why all these other ethnic groups don't want to live with them. And so now we actually understand, and, you know, and I think that the reconciliation process in the Balkans is somewhat different because of the presence of the EU, the European Union, and its proximity, and because all of the countries in the Balkans have a European, have an invitation from the European Union to join, and some of them actually already joined. And that puts another layer and another, let's say, incentive for these countries to reconcile. So in that sense, you know, although on the level of ordinary citizens, there hasn't been much interaction, or there hasn't been much mingling, at least on the elite level, there has been a lot of interaction, which wasn't the which is kind of promising, considering the fact that in the 90s these countries waged wars on each other and were in a very bad relations.
Well, what comes to mind, just after listening to what Ahmed was saying, it's kind of interesting how different divisions cause conflict. Ahmed spoke about geographical divisions, but coming from South Africa, we are talking racial divisions. And in terms of the process of reconciliation, I mean, South Africa has come quite far in terms of trying to build a democracy. But one of our biggest challenges is that as much as we're still very much on a road to healing and trying to move on from our history, the pain might have gone, but the scars don't heal. And that's one of the biggest challenges we face with currently right now in South Africa. And I mean, it's a difficult thing, because the process of reconciliation is actually quite powerful in also creating a ripple effect from generation to generation. But if you don't forgive or you don't heal, that also causes the same effect from generation to generation, in that, and I'll give you a specific example within South Africa right now. As much as we are so many years after the apartheid regime, we still struggle a lot with racial inequality, and it's not out there, you know. It's more of an internal feeling, because you know of your past and you know how your grandparents and your parents struggled and fought for racial equality. It's one of those things where, when you specifically coming from a Black South African, where you come from a cultured background, or a background where you're almost forced to know and learn your history, it does a lot to you when you grow up, in that you feel the pain of your parents, and it doesn't really help in terms of the reconciliation process in South Africa. What we're currently battling with is, like I said, a more internal racial inequality. We are currently unhappy with our government. There's a lot of issues of service delivery. But tracking back to the history of our government and how the ANC came into power, the Black majority, it was a historical event for Black people in South Africa to actually have a Black man in power. And it's been a long process. But what we're facing right now is the Black man has failed us. We still struggle with issues of water, sanitation, the environment, access to proper healthcare. And that, in a sense, feels like the Black man has failed us. But it is so difficult when we look at it in a way that our official opposition is actually a white majority. And we are, it's almost like a, as a black person, you're almost stuck in limbo or some weird place, because you thinking, when you track back and you look at your history and you just think about your loyalty and where your loyalties lie, should I remove the black man in power and essentially vote for the opposition? That is like bringing, if I brought a white person into power, we still live with that fear that the apartheid regime might just come back, or you might just feel like a minority again as a black person. So in a sense, we're in a difficult situation right now, in that we are having to almost smile and sit through our struggles without having to fight, because either way, we don't have a sense of freedom, and that's how I see it. You have a right to vote, but you know, it's a bit difficult when it comes to the voting process, and that in effect has now resulted in young people refusing to vote, because if I vote for the official opposition, I have now failed my parents. I've failed my history as a black person. So it's a bit of a difficult situation that we're facing right now.
And some of the things you just touched on, Anneli, have to do with issues of inequality that have not gone away. And I know that's true in several of these situations where even if people are equal on paper, there's still one group of people in control of the government, or they have economic advantages over another that go back. I'm wondering people's thoughts. How great an obstacle is that? Can peoples themselves come to see each other as equals if day in and day out it's clear that that's not the case in society?
Well, looking at my country, it's I think you need to consider the generational gap and the change that happened, because my parents, who you know lived and were brought up during the Soviet Union, would say that they never had issues with someone from Armenia. They went to school with Armenians and the Jews and the Russians, and it was never an issue. And I think the inequality, the issue of inequality kicks in after actually Azerbaijan gained its independence, because we have those issues more now than we did back in the day. And so there is a lot of discrepancy in terms of what people who have access to actually learning and being exposed to reconciliation, to conflict resolution, to conflict transformation, and between those who don't have this opportunity. And I think it's it probably changes from a country to a country where there is a conflict. But specifically, when I look at Azerbaijan, this is something that I feel that exists as a challenge. You have inequality in access to information. You have inequality of, you know, even free thinking. Or thinking analytically, or thinking differently from what your official government says. And it's hard to work around, but that's why there are a lot of civil societies who do these track to diplomacy meetings, where they bring together people from the two countries and try to organize different meetings and conferences where they can actually discuss these challenges and look in ways how they can minimize the inequality of, in this particular case, you know, access to information and access to, you know, sharing knowledge.
Just to expand on what Arzu's saying, it's a bit of a tricky situation, because in South Africa we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was set up to obviously give those that felt they were oppressed, those that lost, that obviously. Lost a lot of friends and family members in the struggle. It was basically a platform set up for you to almost talk about it and share similar stories with other people. But it's almost like you cannot, as much as we try to have sessions and debates and you know, reconciliation programs, the difficulty in it is, it doesn't replace what you've lost. I think that that's the challenge that comes with reconciliation. When we're talking about thousands of people that died, when we talk about, and it's very personal for me, but when we talk about, in my situation, a mother that died, how do I, reconciliation does not necessarily bring her back. And it does a lot for one's feelings, because how do you, it's very challenging, like I said, how do you move on from that? How are you accepting? And I think with what you're asking, it really is a matter of the individual. I mean, it really does depend on how you're going to act as an individual going forward. Do you decide to almost connect your past with your present? Do you try to move on? And how do you then educate others? And how do you go through a process of healing with others as well? But like I said, it's almost like we can talk about it, but it's not going to erase everything, and it's not going to bring what you've lost. It's not going to bring it back.
Unlike South Africa, we in the Balkans, I mean, in former Yugoslavia, had a somewhat different approach, which wasn't based on reconciliation through Truth and Reconciliation commissions. Actually, they tried to set up one, but it failed. Our main kind of mechanism was war crime tribunals because of the Civil War and all that. And the first war crime tribunal was actually set up by the United Nations. It was the International Tribunal on Former Yugoslavia, which was set up in the 90s. And some of the biggest villains of the war, like Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadžić and Slobodan Milošević, were tried there. And some are still on trial. And what was obvious in the 90s is that those countries that that were born out of the collapse of former Yugoslavia and the Civil War, they weren't capable of dealing with their own war criminals. And that was the reason why the International Tribunal was set up, because nobody was putting these people on trial. What happened in the meantime, especially in the last 12 years, is that slowly the internal capacity to investigate war crimes and to process war crimes, each in their own country, and also the cooperation between different countries on investigations of the war crimes, increased. And that wasn't registered because it never came with a bang. It was something that was appearing slowly and slowly over the years. And currently, there is a number of cases that is being done in many war crime departments of courts in all these countries, especially in Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia. Serbia being like one of the kind of most efficient, having one of the most efficient departments for processing war crimes, which is kind of, you know, like something that we should salute. But what turned out to be the case is that even these war crime trials didn't make an effect of you know that was intended, and that the victims and their families were not in most cases satisfied with the outcomes of the trials. So the question is the legal side of the reconciliation process enough? Because it seems it isn't, and that it has to be accompanied with something else. I guess somebody or some organization or some intergovernmental or non-governmental or, you know, whatever initiative needs to make sense of these trials, to put them in context and to give some sort of, you know, maybe further explanation and further meaning that will be more helpful for the reconciliation process, because the trials themselves didn't make that effect. There is one more thing, and that actually what Arzu was saying about how her parents thought that in the Soviet Union they could, the Armenians and Azerbaijanis could you know, live together without. We have the similar experience. If I ask my parents, like in former Yugoslavia, everybody lived happily, you know, and there was no problem whatsoever. But, you know, then we have to ask ourselves, like, why did the war start then? You know, because, and I remember when I was a kid that, you know, and it comes back to the question that you, Andrew, asked about inequality. I remember when I was a kid in the mid-80s, when the preparation for the war was going on in all the republics, in all the parts of the Yugoslav Federation. I would listen in Belgrade how, you know, intellectuals would say that, that Serbia is the strongest and the biggest part of the federation is actually being exploited by the weaker republics. And then I would go down to Croatia for on a vacation at the seaside, and they would tell me how every morning there is an airplane with money collected from tourism flying to Belgrade. So the issue of inequality was tightly related to the issue of ethnic ethnic distance that existed, and after the war, when all these countries kind of were on their own and they couldn't blame each other, then I guess they realized that the inequality that they still have and the economic issues that they still have, they cannot blame now on the other republic because they're on their own now, but the issues are still there. So I guess, you know, it's also the process for each of those states that appeared after the collapse of Yugoslavia, you know, to actually understand better why they had economic problems in the first place.
Well, I find that's quite like funny, because in my country we did not have no courts, we did not have no reconciliation campaigns whatsoever, but we had the exact opposite. After the separation in 2011, which was a result of a referendum of two choices, either unity or separation, what happened is, after the CPA was signed, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005, ending the war, we had a small margin of freedom in Sudan for like first time in a long time. Newspapers emerged, cultural centers started opening their doors to for people to actually get to know each other. What happened after the separation is the government closed every and each one of those newspapers or centers. And there is one official statement said that we will not allow Southerners to stay in the North, and they should all go back to the South, even though some of them were born and raised in the North. And he reached the point where he said, we will not medicate them in our hospitals. And there is a bastard named Tayyip Mustafa, who is the president's uncle, who was allowed to actually have a new newspaper called the Intibaha, which he basically preaches the alienation of the Southerners who are in the South, who are in the North. And he established a party as well, the Just Peace Forum Party, which he also preaches, you know, the dangers of the, I'm quoting one of their forums, the dangers of the alien existence of Southerners in the North, where they openly speak up about their thoughts. A friend of mine once said, intellectual war does not end by political defeat. He was referring to the secession, because what we really need to start reconciliation and living peacefully is getting rid of the dictatorship and the stupidity of the racists who are actually running the country. The army that was active in the civil war against the government, there were many armies, but the most active one was the SPLM, the Sudan People Liberation Movement, which was led by Dr. John Garang. Well, it had leaders, I mean the sector, military sectors, it had leaders who were from the North, basically. Northerners who picked up arms and to fight this government, and now most of them are in prisons for treason. And so, yeah, basically you cannot have reconciliation unless you have democracy.
But what is democracy? I pose this question because we are almost 20 years in South Africa into so-called democracy. Democracy in 1994 meant black and white live together. Black children can go to white schools, and I quote, you know, essentially we're talking multiracial schools. Democracy meant the right to vote. Democracy meant we can now get along, black and white get along, live together, we smile together, and we forget our past. You know, but reconciliation needs democracy. Democracy means, if I look back to the Freedom Charter of the ANC, how we will now be equal, we must share, the people shall share. That's what they say. Yet right now we have a serious problem of service delivery. I mean, if we're still fighting for housing and water and education, you know, what happened to the Freedom Charter? Have we even reconciled? We're living in a democracy. I mean, that's what it was, 1994. You know, those were all the hopes and dreams that we had. But it doesn't feel like a democracy to me. And whether we reconcile or not, we're not living in a democracy. So I don't know. It just feels a bit, yeah.
Well, I kind of look at it in a in a different way, because in this particular conflict, there is lack of communication between the people themselves. I mean, the governments communicate enough, and what we're trying to do, and what an organization similar to ours are trying to do, is to actually get in touch with people and reconcile on that level. It's like the people-to-people diplomacy. Because what we see and what we realize is that the government might be saying a number of different things on many different levels. What's absent is the communication between the people themselves. And that's what essentially is actually hurting the whole process of reconciliation in Armenia and Azerbaijan, because there's not enough contact, there is not enough meeting, there are not enough meetings, and people get lost or, you know, consumed in their own kind of issues, and, you know, talking about Karabakh becomes like a more of a nationalistic topic where, you know, you sometimes even have to say the things that the government says, which are not necessarily true. So I think it really, like, hearing what everyone has been talking here, it's like a very different country-specific issue. And, you know, and sometimes when you talk about, Ahmad is talking about dictatorship, I consider it more on, you know, but what people can do themselves. And I feel like, you know, steps should be taken on that level, on, you know, on the community level.
Well, I agree. I totally agree. that I think of art, specifically films, as like the perfect tool for doing this, for communicating between people their experiences and their shared ambitions, because we all want the same thing in the end. So yeah, governments do not care about that. All governments need us to be segregated because that's easier for them. But in order for us to actually live together, understand that we need to live together, we need to know each other first.
You know, you mentioned art, right, as another form. Within the organization that I work with, we use literature as well, reading and writing specifically. But the challenge is, even with these forms of art and finding creative ways to communicate, the difficulty is that we still have to educate before we communicate. So you cannot write a book to somebody who was historically oppressed because they cannot read or write, or they just think books are overwhelming because of their experiences within the apartheid regime. It is so bad that in the township, reading is not common. It's considered, if you're found reading, it's like a little stigma of some sort. And you feel books are overwhelming. And if you see somebody reading at a bus stop, it kind of, you look like the weirdo almost. Like you're an alien in the township if you read right now. So communicating can be very effective. However, within the current situation in South Africa, you first have to educate before you communicate with people.
Now, the focus by international media and more structured forms of reconciliation is often the recognition of past wrongs. In the case of South Africa, we've talked about apartheid, and in other cases, we can go as far as genocide. And different countries around the world have taken different approaches to acknowledging the past, and that includes whether it's a government statement, all the way down to what ends up in the history textbooks in school, what happened in this country. And sometimes the debate over that recognition itself is a sticking point, keeping things from moving forward. I'm wondering, what are people's thoughts about what are the issues tied to recognition, and what works and what doesn't work in terms of recognizing the past, and is there a value in that? What is that value?
Well, coming from the Balkans, which many people say produces more history than it can consume, and, you know, having like lived in a different time, where before the Civil War, when the history, our history books, although they were unified, were pretty much kind of distorted in order for them to be unified, and that created over time this alternative history. So in families, tales were told about the other side, about, you know, people living on the other side of the river, or, you know, living in another village or something. And these proved to be very powerful. So even when we had the unified history books, it didn't help. And we ended up with the Civil War because of the alternative history which was told in the... And each of those ethnic groups had their own history, and they were like in mirror to one another. So the only thing that we can agree on is the ancient history, the Roman Empire and ancient Greece. Everything coming after that is in dispute. So even today, after this Civil War and after the collapse of Yugoslavia, there has been attempts to and there has been made some progress has been made to create some sort of unified perception on what happened, and to maybe there are initiatives where history teachers are brought together to kind of coordinate their works on the curricula, and sometimes this work makes some progress, sometimes it doesn't, but still the underlying causes for ethnic tension, as long as they are still there, you know, we're still going to have these alternative histories, and we're still going to have people or political forces that will be preaching ethnic hatred. So when I look at the at former Yugoslavia and the Balkans, which is a very complex place, which had at least within the civil war of the breakup of former Yugoslavia, there were actually four wars, and maybe we could say there were five. But if we look at all those countries that managed to solve their territorial disputes actually are making much bigger progress when it comes to reconciliation. And the countries that still have some territorial disputes are lagging behind. So in a sense, we cannot talk about the process of reconciliation independently of the political, economic, social, and other reasons for the conflict, and that is the job especially for the politicians, but also for the organized citizenry, to create political action that is going to lead to the solution of the problems that are fueling the conflict, because then, you know, the process of reconciliation can be much faster and maybe much more efficient.
Well, building up on what Ivan said, you know, it's what if the politicians are not interested in creating that alternative rhetoric, which is, I consider, the case in both Armenia and Azerbaijan. You know, having the conflict placed to their advantage because, you know, they get either assistance or they can constantly talk about it in their talk, saying that, oh, we have conflict, we have refugees, we have, you know, internal displaced people. And that really very much affects the whole reconciliation process. Now, the Balkans are much more advanced in terms of, you know, even coming up with common history textbooks, because that's not even a part of the discussion now in Armenia, Azerbaijan. In fact, one of the projects that we did recently was on history textbook projects together with some of the teachers from the regions. And you know, it's once you read the two different versions of history, it becomes evident that if we are talking about reconciliation, that will require, you know, educational, going back to like changing the whole educational curriculum of the schools, it requires a lot of work on the side of the ministries of education in both countries to actually accept that step. And this is not happening right now. It's a very challenging situation.
So there's something, this is just something that's just coming to my mind, just listening to both Ivan and Arzu. There's something about reconciliation that I have a problem with, and it's the going back part of it. And the challenge would be, how do we reconcile now? Okay, after 20 years, is it really necessary, for example, or do we really want to go back to 20 years ago and open up those wounds?
But I think it's necessary to go back to 20 years ago, or, you know, if it's necessary, 50 years ago, to actually reconcile, because you can't reconcile without addressing, you know, a very emotional, very personal issues. And that's what we try to do, for example, in our dialogue retreats, is that we spend 2 days just discussing history. And it's not about, you know, ignoring history. It's not about forgetting history. It's actually about understanding that we both had losses, that both countries experienced a lot of human losses. But, you know, to get beyond that, you really have to go back. And you really have to sit down and explain to the other side why you think that way. You know, it's a matter of showing the other side that you've been taught this way, just like the other side shows to you that this is how they've been brought up and this is the history that they've been taught. And I think it's not just in like conflict. I think it's really important to address those very specific historical facts if you really want to move forward, because it will come up eventually in the future if you don't address them now.
My issue is, how does it then affect the effectiveness of how the government, or you yourself as an individual, the process, or the many years that you've gone by trying to reconcile with yourself personally, or even within government interventions, non-governmental organizations coming in and kind of working with that process? I mean, I'm saying this because in South Africa, apartheid isn't, it's something that is remembered. we know about it, you know, it's in our curriculums, in schools, we have museums, there's something about restoring that memory and communicating it. But we are talking, the thing is, we're talking 20 years after democracy, and what are the ways in which we can almost go back without having to reopen those wounds from 20 years ago? I mean, it's not like from 1994 we jumped to 2012 and, you know, we didn't reconcile. But you might have gone through your own personal reconciliation, or the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or done something or other, some other intervention from non-governmental NGOs, and, you know, you live in solidarity, both black and white, you move to a suburb and your neighbor's white, you know, it's those kind of things. And then we've now, 20 years into democracy, we are going back again, we are reconciling, we want to raise the issue again, you know. I'm just trying to kind of understand the effectiveness now, or do we really want to? Because it's risky in the fact that we're going back again. And I all of a sudden have opened up my wounds, and I just don't look at my white friend the same way as I did before we started this process right now. You know, I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I mean, the reason why it's brought up again, you know, 20 years or 30 years again, you know, depending on the time frame, is precisely because it wasn't addressed in the very beginning. And, you know, to understand, we're talking about here understanding, you know, we're not talking again about forgetting. It's about understanding and not necessarily, you know, saying that you have to accept my point of view or my history. It's explaining and understanding. And then, you know, thinking that how can you overcome that? Yes, we all have wounds and we all feel vulnerable once we expose them, especially in this kind of very emotional way. But then again, you know, what if it doesn't happen in time? And then, you know, 40 years later, you come up with this similar situation where you still haven't addressed that, and then you have to go, you know, the double the time of history to actually understand that. Mm.
You are listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. We're speaking about the process of reconciliation on a national and international level, and I'm here with Aneli Muzikwa, Ahmed Mahmoud, Arzu Gebulaeva, and Ivan Marovich, all who have different experiences with this issue. What about the role of outside, with this issue? And for our listeners, we are outdoors. We are in the middle of Mexico, and there is a thunderstorm approaching. So that's the explanation for some of the noise we're hearing, but we're hoping it'll hold off for just a few minutes longer. I'm wondering, what about the role of outside parties, be it the United Nations or another third country? What are the pros and cons of having someone who at least theoretically is unbiased in the situation help through the reconciliation process?
In the case of the former Yugoslavia, the United Nations international community played a very big role, and they still do, maybe not so much as they did maybe 10 years ago. But still, we can say that there is a big role for the international community. And what we learned in the last 10, 15 years is that even when the international community attempts to maintain its neutrality and tries to be, how should I say, impartial, they're still accused of bias by all sides. Because people, I guess, don't like foreigners to interfere that much. So whenever the foreigners interfere against one's country or its, you know, policies, or, you know, questions their moves, or even starts an investigation, there is going to be some resistance. So in our case, you know, the tribunal in former Yugoslavia, which was set up by the United Nations, was in Belgrade accused of being anti-Serbian. In Zagreb, it was being accused of being anti-Croat. And when they did trials against the Bosnian generals in Sarajevo, there was like questions like, why are they doing that? So I guess that the role of the international community was very, very controversial. However, having said that, the international community, and by setting up this tribunal, played a very important role, because there was no internal capacity to put these people on trial. And so in order to prevent the situation where the war is going to end and all these things are going to be forgotten, the International Tribunal played the role of at least keeping that on the agenda and putting people on trial and investigating war crimes. What for me is more problematic is the utter lack of professionalism and competence of the of some of the prosecutors and people who were working under the International Tribunal. some of the procedures in the in that court were also totally questionable. So it's not, for me, the bias of the tribunal was the which is the problem, but its competence. And what it turned out, which is quite a paradox, but I guess, you know, gives us some room for optimism, is that the national courts in the countries of former Yugoslavia, when they took over some of the cases from the International Tribunal, did actually a much better job in investigating and prosecuting than the International Tribunal did, which is kind of a paradox, especially because these countries are considered underdeveloped, without proper judicial and other tradition and all that stuff. But it also shows us that, you know, the emphasis on creating capacity in those countries, to creating capacity they can themselves prosecute people who were responsible for war crimes, was actually the right direction. And once the emphasis was put on the national courts, actually the progress was made, because the International Tribunal could only prosecute very, how shall I say, high-ranking politicians and military officers. They couldn't go to a broad investigation of different abuses that were happening all around the former Yugoslavia. What national courts could do was actually prosecute not just high-ranking but low-ranking officers and soldiers, and that actually helps figure out what was going on the ground, not just the big picture, but also all these personal stories, and that can lead to certain satisfaction, if we can say so, or something for the victims of many of those who were killed during the war.
Well, the UN or foreign interference. I mean, I kind of have like a problem with this on the level of, for example, George Clooney visiting the war zone in the New South of Sudan. Yes, there has been the South separated and the New South also broke into war, thanks to my government. I mean, George Clooney visiting the area and talking to the victims. I would have loved to see a Sudanese man or woman who, from the same ethnicity of the men who are actually bombing the victims. I kind of think that would have sent a stronger message to the victims and to the Sudanese people in the north as well. It's just a thought.
Well, it again, you know, it changes from a country to a country. In our particular case, we had an organization called OSCE, Minsk Group, that's been monitoring the conflict process ever since the ceasefire, basically. And we've lost hope in this, international organization, because you would think that with that kind of assistance, you would have some kind of progress in the resolution process, the reconciliation process, but there's been none. And so it's been a very, it's kind of like losing hope and not expecting a lot more from international intervention. It depends.
So we're almost out of time here, and I think Mother Nature is also letting us know it's almost time to go. The first raindrops have fallen. Are there any more insights folks here have gained through your own experiences that you'd like to share? Is there a magic secret to reconciliation, especially not that the job is done anywhere else, but in Ahmed's case, it's a much fresher, newer process, perhaps, you know, words of wisdom, particularly Arzu. I mean, you take this issue head on in your work with Armenian, Azerbaijani youth and adults. What have you learned through that about people's willingness to change their personal opinions of each other? What works and what doesn't work?
Well, there is no magic trick. as there is no magic trick for anything else pretty much going on in the world today. But what I've learned is that you meet a lot of different people from with very different backgrounds and very different mindsets. And, you know, you might come across people who come to these dialogue retreats or to these meetings without necessarily thinking for better. So that's one of the things that people should keep in mind, that you know, just having a cross-border meeting doesn't mean that everyone who comes there will be like so pro-peace and they will change their opinions immediately. But more on a positive note, especially working with youth, I see so much more positivity in them and so much more willingness. Of course, there are those who are just as negative as there are positive people. But it gives you hope because, you know, this is the generation that will carry on living in the two countries, will carry on, I hope, their built relationships through these kind of programs and through these kind of meetings. You know, it's a very, I think it's an important factor. I think it's a very important step in their lives to be able to actually make that decision and come to those kind of cross-border meetings. And, you know, just as there's always, you know, negative and so much like negativity around this kind of topic, and you always have to think or at least hope for the best, and that this something will change and that people will start looking at things differently. Of course, I'm not, you know, trying to draw like a perfect bubble pink world when people will just, you know, reconcile and live perfectly happily ever after, but at least you know, the experience shows that yes, there are people who will be very negative, they'll not change their opinions, but the experience also shows that some people do change, and they do, you know, leave with a lot more, with a very different mindset, and I think that's very important, just to have that, and in my own personal work, to see that, you know, 5 months, a year, 2 years after the program, to see the people still communicating and still doing things together, even independently on their own, is promising.
I guess if I can add something to this that can be a bit optimistic, but also it will be a bit troubling, is that, for instance, Serbia had a traditional rival, Bulgaria, for the second half of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. We waged many wars and we had territorial disputes, and it was like if one could look at the Balkan conflict in the late 19th century, it would be a conflict between Serbia and Bulgaria. Currently, Serbia and Bulgaria have no territorial disputes, have no problems with one another. So it seems that somehow over the last 50 years, these things, you know, were reconciled, but we didn't pay attention to that. So if that brings some hope that, you know, like at least 50 years from now, our children are going to be okay with, you know, people from Croatia or people from Bosnia, and maybe the underlying reasons for the conflict are going to be resolved as well. So maybe then we will, you know, be fully reconciled. But that also brings us to the troubling part of that, is that the reconciliation process, if it's that long, like 50 years or something, is pretty much irrelevant for us today, because we will not be in terms of political or any other involvement, we ourselves won't be relevant in 50 years. And maybe we should, you know, think more about what is going to be our small contribution in the long mm-hmm. process of reconciliation, rather than thinking about some like quick fixes that are going to be bringing reconciliation anytime soon.
I would like to actually talk about a small contribution of mine. I have this friend, her name is Josephine, and she was born and raised in the north, in Khartoum, after her parents came as refugees from the south. According to the government laws, coming next April, she's no longer a Sudanese citizen. She graduated from law school, actually, one of the best schools in Khartoum. So I decided to actually make a film about her. So I made like a 20-minute film about her last days, and I think somehow this will add to the long run of reconciling with the people in the south.
Well, I think the process of reconciliation really, it essentially starts with an individual. And with what Arzu's saying, that the positive part of this is when you see an individual change. And the moment it starts with one person, and it almost becomes a ripple effect, and it we re-engage with each other as people, that's when we'll essentially have see some change and have some reconciliation. Coming from a racial perspective, I mean, we in South Africa, yes, we've come a long way. Racial inequality is not as bad as it used to be, and that's very impressive, and that's the positive side. I mean, we see something like the World Cup, for example. We hosted the 2010 World Cup, and as much as we even see racial divisions in sports in South Africa, I mean, soccer is black is generally a black dominated sport. Rugby is white dominated. But we hosted the Soccer World Cup in 2010, and we saw white and black people come together and get along. I think it's those small things. A rugby game, you know, when you see black and white, Indian, colored, mixed race, pink, blue, yellow, come together and actually get along as people. I mean, that is essential in the reconciliation process. It almost speeds it up. You don't necessarily have to go back. But when you're here and you decide to take a conscious decision to move forward, it's like a self-facilitation thing, and it moves much faster.
I want to thank all of you for a great discussion. Ivan Maravich, Aneli Muzikwa, Ahmed Mahmoud, and Arzu Gebulaeva. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we will link to all of their websites and other sites mentioned during this discussion on our website, which is radioproject.org.